Well, turn with me to Daniel 6 if you have a copy of God's Word with you this morning. Two themes come together for us in Daniel 6. One we've been singing about, God as our rescuer, God as a redeemer, God who is strength to the needy, to the weak. The second theme is something we've been seeing throughout the book of Daniel, God's people in a foreign land. How do they live there? Where do they draw lines? What hills do they die on? What's acceptable and what's not acceptable for Daniel in Babylon, or we could say for Christians in this world? If we proclaim the lordship and the exclusive mercy that's in Jesus Christ to this world, won't some be mad? And if we don't, can anybody be saved? If we stand 100 yards away from the closest non-Christian, can they really see our faith? And if we get close, if we get involved in their lives and they in ours, won't it get messy? That's Daniel. We're going to study Daniel 6, but first I want to get our bearings with some principles from Matthew 5. You don't have to turn there because we'll put the text up here in the screens from you. Matthew 5, a few verses there, Jesus gives this parable of salt and light. He gives the illustration of the Christian life as one that's both salt and light. The salt is in verse 13. It goes like this. You are the salt of the earth, but if the salt has become tasteless, how can it be made salty again? It is no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled underfoot by men. The salt principle is like this. Salt doesn't do any good unless it's touching the thing it's supposed to affect. When we see salt in Matthew 5 here, don't think seasoning like your steak. It enhances things. Think instead first century times with no refrigeration. Think that salt was there for preserving. Salt was there to keep something. Christians are salt in this world, which means they're involved in God's preserving work, but it has to be mingled in. Just like you would season a steak. You know, you get out even maybe a seasoning hammer, a tenderizing hammer. You hammer seasoning into the fibers of that steak. It's got to get in there. Salt at 10 feet away doesn't do anything. It's just white stuff. But if salt loses its savor, if salt loses its saltiness, it doesn't matter what it's touching. It has to still be salty. Christians still have to have that Christian identity, that Christian pursuit of holiness, that Christian love for God and love for His Word, that difference. If not, it says in verse 13, they become worthless. Salt, no matter what it's up against, if it has lost its saltiness, is worthless. Then there's a light principle, salt and light, verses 14 through 16. It says, you are the light of the world, a city set on a hill which cannot be hidden. Nor does anyone light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a lampstand. It gives light to all who are in the house. Let your light shine before men in such a way that they may see your good works and glorify your Father who's in heaven. The light principle is so similar, but a different analogy. It says, if the light is dim, if there's not much to it, if it's just a small flicker instead of a bright torch, then it doesn't really have much effect no matter how public you try to make it, no matter where you put it in the house. If it's a small little flame, it doesn't do much at all. So our light is supposed to be big, even if you're showing it off to the world, but it is dim and weak and not very distinct, then it really doesn't have the intended purpose that God has for us. But also, it could be bright, but you hide it. You hide it away. You think that light can get dirty if it shines on dirty things. Think about that just as a principle. Light can't get dirty because it's around dirty stuff. Light exposes the dirt. So if you think, well, if we're out there, if we're in it, we'll get it. Well, some Bible verses do apply to that. Be careful who you make friends with. It's a huge theme in Proverbs. But Remember that Jesus was a friend of sinners. Just like the salt has to get in it for it to affect it, so the light has to be near it. No matter how bright it is, if it's covered up, if it's hidden, if you say, we have to protect our light. It's windy out there. We have to protect our light. Let's go back under this hill. Let's not be on the top of the hill. Let's go over here behind the hill. And, well, they don't see it, do they? So it's hard to get the salt and the light right, isn't it? It's hard. We admit it. It's not easily done. We tend to either be weak and not salty, or we tend to be salty and withdrawn. We tend to be either dim as a light, but holding it boldly to the world, or maybe a bright light that's tucked away and hidden for safety. But even when we get it right, only some will glorify our Father in heaven. Look, that's the end of it. Maybe they'll see these good works, this light, and they will glorify your Father in heaven. Or, look at what these verses say earlier. Matthew 5, 10 to 12, we missed this part just before the Beatitudes. Jesus said, blessed are those who have been persecuted for the sake of righteousness, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Persecuted for the sake of righteousness. They got the salt and the light right. And they're persecuted. Some will glorify your Father in heaven when you get salt and light right. And some won't like salt and won't like light, and they will persecute you for it. Blessed are you when people insult you and persecute you. They'll say insulting things, they'll persecute you, and they'll lie about you. Falsely say all kinds of evil against you because of me. Rejoice and be glad, for your reward in heaven is great. In the same way they persecuted you, they persecuted the prophets who were before you. Some will hate, some will persecute, some will lie, and some will get to glorify our Father in heaven. Okay, you want to see the story version of these principles? Keep these principles in mind as we go to Daniel 6 now to see the story version. Just like Christians today, Daniel has a mission to go into the real world, to be salt and light and to see change, and a call to stay faithful while he's there, to not lose his savor or else he'll become useless. Look at the first five verses of Daniel 6. It seemed good to Darius to appoint 120 satraps over the kingdom, that they would be in charge of the whole kingdom, and over them three commissioners, of whom Daniel was one, that these satraps might be accountable to them, and that the king might not suffer loss. Then this Daniel began distinguishing himself among the commissioners and satraps because he possessed an extraordinary spirit, and the king planned to appoint him over the entire kingdom. Then the commissioners and satraps began trying to find a ground of accusation against Daniel in regard to government affairs. But they could find no ground of accusation or evidence of corruption, inasmuch as he was faithful, and no negligence or corruption was to be found in him. Then these men said, we will not find any ground of accusation against this Daniel unless we find it against him with regard to the law of his God. Well, this section introduces us to what we could call the man. Daniel is the man. Daniel's the man because he's the man in this chapter. He's the man of this book. His name's on the front of it. But he's the man in this, in the cultural sense. He's the man. This is a great story of manly strength and courage, of conviction, of honor. Look at his character. Verse 3, it says he's distinguished. The man here is distinguished. But what sets him apart? In verse 3, it says he has an extraordinary spirit. It's not clear how to translate this, but it's probably he's charismatic, he's likable, he's friendly, the guy who's, you know, everyone's friend. He's outgoing. We're not sure exactly, but I think you get the idea just from extraordinary spirit that could be in several different directions and probably is many, many different directions of what it means to have an extraordinary spirit. He's disciplined, it says in verse 4. He's faithful. There's no negligence, it says, with him. Also in verse 4, he's involved in government affairs to the highest level. So remember Jeremiah 29, which we talked about at the beginning of this study. At the same time of Daniel being taken captive into Babylon, the prophecy was given. Don't withdraw from Babylon. Don't pray against the city, but instead go into the city, seek its welfare, pray for the city, get involved in seeking its welfare. You will have your welfare. Your life will be so bound up in the city's welfare that its welfare will be your own welfare. That's what Daniel's doing, and he's doing it in this place of serving the king. He's doing it at the highest level of government affairs. And he's doing it, according to verse 4, in an incorruptible way. He's doing it with no ground of accusation. There's no dirt that they can find on this guy. He's been as honest as can be in government. You know, I mean, elections are coming up. We're getting ready to hear all the dirt. We're getting ready to hear, you know, weird things like a paper someone wrote in college. Like, that's necessarily proof of what they're going to be as a president. They may be a bad president. But, man, if you read some of the stuff I wrote in college, you wouldn't want me as your pastor, right? So, the dirt will come out. We'll see dirt left and right. With Daniel, though, he's incorruptible. They have no ground for accusation. In verse 5, he's known for his commitment to the law of his God. And so that's where they have to turn. That's where they have to turn to accuse him, to overthrow him. By the way, wouldn't it be great if your enemies went looking for dirt and all they found was God? That's all they found was God. They went looking for dirt in your life, went looking for dirt in your past, and all they found was, we'll have to get him on God. Boy, we'd sleep good, wouldn't we? That's Daniel. And this character means, this character stuff that we're talking about in verses 3 and 4 and verse 5, it means that the king loves him. And he's moved up the king's ladder at a great rate here. He's advanced in the king's kingdom. But it also means that this character leads to the enemies hating him. And they seek to destroy him. Keep in mind that principle we've seen before in the book of Daniel, that we should take opportunities, unique opportunities that have unique influence. Take opportunities to be a politician, if you can, to the glory of God. Do things that others can't. Don't think that God's calling on your life, if you're going to be godly, means missions or means ministry, full-time ministry, means to be a preacher or something. Maybe it does, but maybe it doesn't. If you have the smarts to go into the biology world and do great things for God, and maybe that doesn't mean at a Christian school. Maybe that means at a public school, a public university, where you get to be around people who don't believe what you believe. Go into those unique opportunities. And sometimes those unique opportunities of unique influence mean glam and fame and intellect and politics and power. But sometimes it means going to the gutter. Sometimes it means going to the ghetto. Doesn't it? The principle isn't go to the places that are famous and go to the places that are cool and go to the places where you're really known and the spotlight is big. The principle is great influence by going to places of greatest need that fit you. And it's not just an issue of whether you'll be a politician like Daniel or serving in the gutter, serving in the ghetto in some way that is far less famous and far less powerful, so it seems. You know what? It's not just two extremes. There are a million extremes or a million different options here in the middle, aren't they? You find unique opportunities for unique influence that fit you. The second thing here after the man is the scheme. The scheme. Look at verses 6 through 9 with me for this scheme that you can already feel coming. Then these commissioners and satraps came by agreement to the king and spoke to him as follows. King Darius, live forever. All the commissioners of the kingdom, the prefects and satraps, the high officials and the governors have consulted together that the king should establish a statute and enforce an injunction that anyone who makes a petition to any god or man besides you, O king, for 30 days shall be cast into the lion's den. Now, O king, establish the injunction.
sign the document so that it may not be changed according to the law of the Medes and the Persians, which may not be revoked. Therefore, King Darius signed the document that is the injunction. Who are these satraps? Satraps just means viceroy. So if you, Star Wars, you know, think of queen or princess, whatever she was, Amadilla, and not so fast, viceroy, you know, that kind of. Don't go down that path, actually. Back up. So these are called satraps. And their scheme to get. Stick to the notes, Ryan. Stick to the notes. Don't do girl imitations anymore. Okay. Note to self. Their scheme to get Daniel is sneaky here. And it doesn't seem like the king even sees that it's going to lead to Daniel. The sneakiness about the way they word it to the king is that they don't make it just about prayer. They don't make it just about praise. They don't make it an issue of worship per se. They say, anyone who makes a petition, king, you're the guy who distributes, who's in charge of all Babylonian things. And so if people will request of someone else or some other god besides you, it may show a hint of a lack of allegiance. And so let's do a test, a 30-day test that's temporary, and we'll kind of do an x-ray of the community and find who's for you and who's maybe against you, who's maybe subversive to your kingdom. See if there are any that don't support you. And the king must not have realized what this implied for Daniel, because Daniel's not even remotely on his radar screen. He doesn't even seem to be remotely concerned about Daniel. In fact, on the contrary, later in the chapter, when Daniel finally does get implicated, the king is horrified at Daniel's fate. Look at verse 14. When the king heard the statement, they turned Daniel in. He was deeply distressed and he set his mind on delivering Daniel even until the sunset. He kept exerting himself to rescue him. Of course, we already saw he signed the law of the Medes and the Persians, so it can't be changed. But he didn't see this coming per se for Daniel, I don't think. Based on the reaction later, he didn't see it coming. And the text tells us he didn't see it coming. But ironically, the passage does seem to hint that Daniel might have seen it coming. Daniel might have known what this meant for him. Look at verse 10. When Daniel knew that the document was signed, he entered his house. And it's going to say that he prayed. But notice, when he knew that the document was signed is the first part of the sentence, which means he knew it was signed, then he went and consciously prayed. He entered his house. In the roof chamber, he had windows open toward Jerusalem. And he continued kneeling on his knees there 3 times a day, praying and giving thanks before his God as he had been doing previously. So this is the third thing, the prayer. The prayer. He prays toward Jerusalem. Why? Well, one hint is 1 Kings 8, when Solomon's consecrating the temple. He anticipates the day when God's people will be under judgment, and they'll recognize their sin and repent, and they will pray toward this place, Solomon says, referring to the temple. And they will confess your name and turn from their sin, and you will forgive them and teach them the good way. So Daniel praying toward Jerusalem meant that he knew that was the place of God's presence. The temple had been destroyed, but he knew the temple was coming back again. He knew the promises of God. He knew that God is everywhere, yes, but God had demonstrated his presence in a unique way in the Old Testament. In Jerusalem, a holy city, and in the temple, his holy house, his house of worship. So he's praying for the restoration of the people to the land. He's repenting. He's counting on the promises of that restoration. He's anticipating that the presence of God is there. He's recognizing that prayer in a foreign land in the Old Testament is less than ideal. He's not in the holy city. He's not in the manifestation of the presence of God in the Old Testament, this Jerusalem and this temple. And get this, he's praying for these things for 80 years. 80 years. Daniel has been in Babylon 80 years. It's simple math. Nebuchadnezzar took the first exiles, including Daniel, in 605 BC. And remember, the math works backwards on BC. So
Darius became the ruler of Babylon in 522 BC, 83 years or so. For 83 years, which means Daniel is probably 100 or 90 or 95 or something like that, for those many years, Daniel has been praying three times a day, repenting for the sins of the people, remembering the promises of God. He hasn't been going to church services there in the king's palace. He hasn't been around a ton of prophets necessarily. He's not hearing all of this repeated again. He is reminding himself, and maybe others as well. Maybe they're a small group that is, you know, huddled together and reminds each other of the promises of God and the place of God's presence and the plan to be restored to the land. But they keep praying three times a day. Why? Three times a day. Why three times a day? The only hint of this is in Psalm 55:17. Evening, morning, and noon, I will cry out in distress. Three times a day. Daniel did it three times a day. But why? Well, it's not a commandment. Psalm 55:17, evening, morning, and noon, I will praise you, is not a commandment. It's the psalmist's description of his own prayer life. It doesn't say, three times a day you shall pray. In fact, if you go through the Old Testament, you find morning prayer, you find evening prayer. You don't find God says in the morning you shall pray, God says in the evening you shall pray. You find a lot of descriptions of some guys praying in the morning, you find a lot of descriptions of some guys praying in the evening. So Daniel didn't have to, but he made it for some reason his regular habit. He disciplined himself to do it. He thought it was a good idea. That's it, he thought it was a good idea. It seemed like a good thing to do. It's just the same for us. We can pray anywhere. We can pray everywhere. We can pray about anything. We can pray at different times for different occasions. The Bible doesn't tell us that prayer time is to happen in the morning or it's supposed to happen in the evening. You might say, well, it makes sense to do it in the morning. That way you get it out of the way and make sure it's done. Okay, Mr. Banker. But I know this rock and roll guy who doesn't get up till 10 and he just gets going about 11 at night. So he's going to pray better at night. Just let him be. Don't cast stones at this. And this is really a tough thing for us today. We tend to go to one or two extremes here. We tend to just be on one side or the other. And so to the one extreme, I would say, God hasn't told us to pray three times a day or nine times a day. Don't pretend like He has. Don't make up rules that God hasn't made up. Don't be a lawgiver. Do you realize how scary it is of a thing for you to make rules either for others or even for yourself and treat them not just as good ideas that you plan to discipline yourself for, but you make them law? You know what you do? You are playing lawgiver. You don't do that. You're not the lawgiver. And so I would say, God has not specified specific things, and don't get too specific for others. Don't tell others that they have to do prayer just like you do prayer. Don't tell others they have to pray as long as you pray. The Bible does not say any good Christian prays a half hour a day and he makes sure to go through a thorough list of missionaries. It doesn't say that. So just, here's where we have to have flexibility. Good ideas are different than divine commandments. But to the other extreme, I would say, there is nothing wrong with setting goals. There is nothing wrong with planning to pray. In fact, if you don't plan to pray, usually you don't. If you don't set aside a time for prayer, prayer rarely goes deep. It rarely communes with God. It rarely is very meaningful. The Puritans used to say, you need to pray until you've prayed. You know what that means, I think, don't you? You know from experience what that means, that there's one thing to pray, and then there's another thing to keep praying until you actually have prayed. You just keep praying until you're actually communing with God and it's special. You need a time to do that. You need a set aside, disciplined, planned time to do that, or you'll never do that. So you have to keep good ideas separate from commandments without despising good ideas. Does that make sense? It's very important for us in our own lives and how we treat others, how we imply or say how others should live. But back to Daniel, despite the threat of this new law, he does his regular times of prayer, three times a day toward Jerusalem, even though he could have been justified in not doing that. Is it possible he still would have violated the king's commandment to not request of anybody? If you pray, you're gonna be in trouble here. But what if he did it at night? Instead of three times a day, which was his habit, what if he did three times a night? What if he just does one time a day instead of three times a day? Is he violating any principles of God's word? No, he's not. We have to keep that in mind. But he is inflexible on this. He draws a line in the sand. And so we have to say, even though Daniel's good ideas are not divine commandments, why is he inflexible on this? Well, it's not that he's being a stubborn legalist. It's not that he's confusing God's laws with his good ideas. It's not that he's making his own religious rules. He is consistent about his conviction in applying God's principles for prayer. For him to stop praying would have been wrong. It would have been sin. For him to pray in a different way would have not necessarily been sin, but maybe sin for Daniel, because he thought that the basis for it would have been something other than God. Let me show you what I mean by thinking about this, that he doesn't shut the window. Why doesn't he shut the window? God doesn't say, every time you pray, it better be an open window, or it hits glass, it bounces, it doesn't get through, I don't hear it. I hear pretty good, but not that good. No. Why an open window? I don't know. But after hearing of the new law, Daniel could have gone in one or two extremes here. He could have not done what he used to do, but instead marched down to the city center, done his three times a day right in the king's court. He could have done a little stick it to the man via prayer. And he doesn't do that, does he? Daniel strikes a balance here by doing the exact same thing he had been doing. Because he didn't do it for people before, he's not gonna not do it because people might be involved now. He didn't open the window so people could see, so now he's not gonna close the window so that they don't see. He strikes this great balance. He could have staged a protest. I would have bet he's pretty influential in the city. He doesn't pray for the sake of people. He doesn't not pray for the sake of what it might cost him. He's got a quiet, steady, godly confidence. He's courageous without being contentious. He's not militant. He's not in your face with his prayer. He doesn't make it an us versus them thing. Now that they've declared war on prayer, I'll show them. He doesn't try to change the legislation, go to the king and say, King, rethink this. King, come on, I'm your number two guy. Trust me, this is not good. It's going to lead to me in trouble, and you're ready to give me the kingdom. You're ready to pass this on to me. He doesn't do it. He doesn't talk about the violation of his rights. Which, that's something we talk about today. Well, what about our rights, violation of rights? And there's a time to talk about that if it does violate actual declaration of rights, if it does, you know, violate our amendments. Sure, let's talk about that. But you know what? Think of how weird it would have been for Daniel to talk about his rights. He's a Jew in Babylon. Anything is bonus, right? He's a slave there. He shouldn't be a slave. It's wrong, but he is a slave there. And so he's not talking about his rights. But he's not wimpy. He's not at all wimpy. There's no hint of shame. There's no fear of consequences. He knows what lion's den means. That was exactly what it means. He probably heard what it sounds like when people get thrown into the lion's den. He knew that the law might get connected to him. He knows that the law of Medes and Persians can't be altered. And so if he does get caught, then he can't get before the king and the king say, oh, it's you, forget it, go on ahead. It can't be altered. But he goes up in his room and he prays with the windows open. Verse 10 says he continued praying three times a day. And verse 13 says, as they tell the king, he keeps praying three times a day, which means multiple days. He kept doing it. And the satraps had been watching. And they bust him. Look at verse 11. Then these men came by agreement and found Daniel making petition and supplication before his God. And they take him to the king. Which leads to the fourth thing here. The lions. Look at verse 16, which tells us about these lions in their den. The king gave orders.
Daniel was brought in and cast into the lion's den. The king spoke and said to Daniel, may your God, whom you serve constantly, may he deliver you. Look at verse 18. The king went off to his palace and spent the night fasting. No entertaining was brought before him, and his sleep fled from him. He's so concerned about Daniel. He's anticipating that maybe Daniel's God will rescue him. He's sleepless that night. So we quickly in the story come to this fifth thing, the rescue. The rescue. Look at verse 19. The king arose at dawn. He can't wait. At the break of day, he went in haste to the lion's den. When he come near the den to Daniel, he cried with a troubled voice. It's just littered to this passage how much the king is troubled. The king spoke and said, Daniel, servant of the living God, has your God, whom you continually serve, been able to deliver you from the lion's den? Then Daniel spoke to the king, O king, live forever. And he didn't need to say anything else, but he tells us this. My God sent his angel and shut the lion's mouths, and they have not harmed me, inasmuch as I was found innocent before him, and I have committed no crime before you, O king. God sent his angel to shut the lion's mouth. What's that look like? Well, before you're tempted to think, well, I'm sure there's a logical explanation instead of the miraculous explanation. Maybe the lions were tired. They're just sleepy. Daniel, as the king comes up and says, Daniel, are you okay? He goes, shh. They're sleeping. No, no hint of that. Maybe they're full. Maybe they don't like Jewish guys. I don't know. Whatever explanation you're tempted to put here, there is none other than God sent his angel, and Daniel knows it. It's not just that lions stared at him all night, or that they slept. It's that he saw something, an angel of the Lord, God's angel, shutting the mouth of lions. Oh, to be a fly on the wall of that cave. But remember, God doesn't always shut the lion's mouth, does he? He doesn't always get us out of every rescue and give us every break. In fact, in the first century times, Christians left and right literally got lions and died. God does not always shut the lion's mouth, either in our small trials or even in martyrdom. Jesus told us that we're going to be persecuted for righteousness' sake. The Apostle Paul said that all who live godly in Christ Jesus will suffer persecution. It's going to happen. So Daniel 6 doesn't point to Christians today being rescued from every lion in their lives. It's not emblematic of the Christian life. If someone tells you, based on this passage, if you go God's way, if you believe Him, if you trust Him, if you are obedient, then nothing will happen to you. No scratches will be on you. Oh, friend, that's a lie, and it's a dangerous lie. It's a cruel lie. Daniel's message, his rescue here, points to a greater rescue. And this greater rescue gives us courage and encouragement while we're going through the small lion's dens of our lives. You see, God dealt with the final lion, the ultimate lion of our judgment. Jesus dealt with the final and ultimate lion of our judgment, which was before the ultimate king. Not King Darius, who, you know, his hands were tied because he couldn't undo the law of the Medes and the Persians. This judgment that we have before the King of Kings and Lord of Lords is just. It's just. Unlike Daniel's judgment, ours is just. But Jesus dealt with our judgment. He shuts the lion's mouth of your eternal damnation through his work upon the cross. Any passage of the Old Testament that speaks of rescue ultimately points to the final and complete, the ultimate quintessential rescue of our souls. So we're not wrong in running to Jesus here. In fact, there are even some hints in the story that point to some similarities. Look at verse 17. I mean, Daniel's wrongly accused. Jesus was wrongly accused. There's kind of this trial, a mock trial, eventually leads to the persecution to his execution. Verse 17, a stone was brought and laid over the mouth of the den, and the king sealed it with his own signet ring, with the signet rings of his nobles, so that nothing would be changed in regard to Daniel. It's like a New Testament story. Rolled a stone in front of the cave, and they put a seal on it so they would know it hadn't been moved. They did the same thing with Jesus. This points finally to Jesus, who shut the mouth of our ultimate judgment for us. And now, because of that, when we go through our small lion's dens, which everyone in here is going through some form of a lion's den, and the lions are growling and you don't know if they're going to bite, if they're going to scratch, or whether there'll be a rescue, you're not promised that you'll get out without a scratch. But the final lion has been dealt with, and it makes the small lions seem much more tame. The Apostle Paul talks about this light, momentary affliction isn't worthy to be compared with the glory, the weight of glory that shall be revealed in us. Not worthy to be compared. He's talking about scales here. Which one weighs more? Which one's heavier? He says, my affliction? Paul's affliction, keep in mind. Paul's affliction. Read 2 Corinthians 12 in chapter 11 as well if you've forgotten Paul's affliction lately. But it's whipping. It's homelessness. It's almost drowning a few times. It's hunger. It's sleeplessness. It's care for the churches. It's a lot of mental worry. Those afflictions Paul calls light and momentary compared to the weight of glory that shall be revealed in us. But also, because the final lion has been dealt with, our judgment's been dealt with on the cross, now we shouldn't be surprised as Christians when God does give us these little moments, these little rescues. Almost miraculous. Maybe it's a healing. Maybe it's a, Lord, you know we need $100 to pay the bills. And something kind of weird happens with the $100. You know, someone gives it to you. You find it in an old shoe. You headed to the beach one day, I guess. You know, I don't know. God provides in unique and special ways. And we shouldn't be surprised when that happens because of the cross. And we shouldn't be devastated when it doesn't happen because of the cross. The cross continues to teach us and encourage us and give us hope in the lion's dens that we're all in right now. Because the ultimate lion's been dealt with. This is what we believe, this is what we proclaim, and so it's what we live out. Now, one last thing, the results here. Look at verses 24 and following. We've got to talk about the king very quickly. The result, the king gave orders, and they brought those men who had maliciously accused Daniel, and they cast them, their children, and their wives into the lion's den. And they had not reached the bottom of the den before the lions overpowered them and crushed all their bones. So apparently they were hungry. And maybe a little mad that their jaws had been shut all night. Because these guys don't hit the ground before the lions get them. Then Darius the king wrote to all the peoples, nations, and men of every language where they were living in all the land, may your peace abound. I make a decree that in all the dominion of my kingdom men are to fear and tremble before the God of Daniel. For he's the living God and enduring forever. And his kingdom is one which will not be destroyed. His dominion will be forever. He delivers and rescues and performs signs and wonders in heaven on an earth, who also has delivered Daniel from the power of the lions. With all these stories in six chapters of Daniel, we have to ask, how'd the king do? We've had three kings now in about five or six different stories. And we have varying responses at the end of the story. How did the king do? Did he get it? Well, did Darius get it? On the one hand, yes. He gets it better than Nebuchadnezzar does at times. Remember, King Nebuchadnezzar at times refers to the Most High God, but it's clear in the following verses that he means God, Daniel's God, is the Most High, but there's still other ones. And that won't do with this God, will it? So Here, Darius seems to get it a little bit better than that. He seems to refer to the God. This God is the God. He seems to get that he's the living God, which means the true and living God. But he doesn't get it, does he? You know how he doesn't get it? He doesn't get it because he not only cast these sneaky guys into the lion's den, which may be part of the justice of this. I mean, the king feels a little bit duped. He realized that they did a checkmate on him and his hands were tied to do something he didn't want to do. Maybe that's a fair judgment back in those days. But women and children as well? They threw their wives and their children in the den as well? That's a just fair retribution. That's not leaving justice to God, is it? And then he says, writing a decree to all the land, men are to fear and to tremble before the God of Daniel. He's legislating fear and awe of Daniel's God. You know what? Daniel could have done that. Daniel hasn't been doing that. In his 80 years in Babylon, Daniel has not sought to legislate God's worship. God will not be worshipped by laws. The Constantinian Empire, that experiment of a Christian nation, failed. We need to learn from it. The king is wrong to legislate fear and awe of this God. This God has been showing himself mighty. And sometimes they get it and sometimes they don't get it. But God will not be legislated here. Daniel has not pursued God being legislated in the land of Babylon. Instead, he wants people to see and actually fear and tremble for themselves. There's no faking it here. And this is what it's like for us. We see fruit. Sometimes men come and they glorify our Father in heaven. And sometimes they persecute and lie and insult us. And a lot of times it's something in between. They get some of it and they don't get a lot of it. It's messy, isn't it? Could Daniel go away discouraged from this? You know, all this, the whole lion's den thing, I wet my pants. Thankfully it dried by morning. You know, I don't know, maybe. Lord, all this and he doesn't really get it? Was it worth it? Well, we don't know what happens next, do we? And that's not a tune in next week. We don't know what happens next. It's not in the next chapter. We don't know, but the results aren't ours. We do God's will. We look for those opportunities. He changes hearts. We get to be involved in his reconciling work and his preserving the earth work. We are to do it, but we're not to be discouraged when either they'll persecute us or insult us or lie about us, or when they'll just vaguely get half right and half wrong. I mean, I don't know about you, but when I talk to people about the Lord and I'm in a long-term friend relationship with these people, it takes so many conversations. You think you had like this whole half hour about the gospel. You think they got it. You think all they got to do now is just embrace it, believe it. And then the next conversation, somehow they went to Mars and got new information and bought into that and totally reinterpreted what you said. You're just going, man, I cannot communicate at all. I thought I still... And maybe it's not our miscommunication. Maybe it's just that's the way faith works. And we forget sometimes us... We ourselves coming to faith was a bit like that too. So we're to be salt. Remember Matthew 5. Go out, be salt. Don't lose your savor. Don't lose your saltiness. But you got to get in there with your saltiness. You have to get into the fiber of the world like Daniel. If men are going to come to glorify your Father in heaven, and isn't that what you want? Don't you want to see people come from darkness to light? They could see your good works and glorify your Father who's in heaven. Or they might kill you. They might lie about you. Or they might just get it wrong for 40 years of a friendship where you keep giving them truth and they keep getting half of it but not all of it and they still don't believe. But can you do it? Do you want to be doing God's work of reconciling? You want to be salt out there?
It's hard. It's hard to keep the savor. It's hard to keep the saltiness. It's hard to want to stay there where lives are messy. It's hard to be light that is still bright and isn't hidden. You can't go to the monastery with your Bible and live there. Oh, wouldn't it be great if everything was camp? No. For a lot of reasons, but the biggest reason is it's a bunch of Christians coming together. And yes, it's usually a kind of a revival experience, but then what? You're supposed to go! Go into all the world and make disciples! Guys, think about this. We have people in our church right now who are listening to this message. Maybe some in here this morning or on Saturday night or in the next service. They're wondering what kind of conviction this implies for them as they might go to a mission field and die there. Here's a question. Can you go to a mission field where the government says, if you're Christian, you don't get in? Can you fudge the entrance report? Can you call it something else? I don't know. I don't know. And I know there are people in our church who are wondering what Daniel 6 says to this issue. Maybe we should put what we should put and let God settle the rest. I'm just pointing that out to say, what's the application for you? Invite someone to come to Easter weekend. Do you realize we've got people in our church who are saying, what does Daniel 6 mean for those who will go to a mission field where they might be killed? What kind of conviction? Do you pray with your window open? Do you use a mat so they think you're praying to Allah? Or do you refuse to use a mat so they're not confused? This isn't about Allah. I don't know. I don't know those questions. I'm not a missiologist. I'm glad I don't have to work those things out. Where are you working them out, though? What I'm saying is people take Daniel 6 and go to a mission field and die. Man, just invite someone to come next weekend. Just invite someone to come next weekend. Sacrifice your special family time by inviting someone who doesn't have family, who's maybe even homeless, and have them come to a worship service and then over for your souffle or your ham afterwards. Okay? People take Daniel 6 and they go to the mission field and die. Oh, we have it so easy. I mean, the application points for us in 21st century America are usually things like, don't forget your invitation cards. And don't forget those. But boy, there's more to it than that, right? Go and invite someone and then flesh out Daniel 6 in messy lives. Be salt, be light. See people glorify your Father and see people get mad at you and lie about you. Trust God for the results.